from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Clay Shirky believes our interconnected age offers unprecedented opportunity and that today's interactive media offers possibilities far more productive than sitcoms. Shirky thinks the new technological environment provides connective tissue to help us communicate and solve problems, a world where public and private media blend and where information is easily shared and the differences between professionals and amateur journalists blur. The result, he thinks, leads to everything from cell phone reports from Iran to couchsurfing.com. Clay Shirky writes about these changes in a new book called Cognitive Surplus: Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. More from Clay Shirky after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. What do you do with your free time? For most of us, consuming media is a big part of the answer. But times have changed since the days when media consumption was mostly a passive activity. Our media behavior is as much about production as consumption. Media is how you know when and where your friend's birthday party is, writes Clay Shirky. Media is how you know what's happening in Tehran or Tegucigalpa. Media is how you know what your colleagues named your baby. Media is how you know about anything more than 10 yards away. Clay Shirky believes our interconnected world now offers extraordinary opportunity to share information and to transform our collective free time into a reservoir of smarts to do good, something he calls cognitive surplus. Clay Shirky is a professor in New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. His new book is called Cognitive Surplus: Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. And Clay Shirky joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
You begin your book by talking about gin.
Ah, yes.
the 1720s, as part of a description of how during difficult times we tend to anesthetize ourselves against that. And you write, it isn't hard to figure out why people were drinking gin in London in 1720. It's palatable and intoxicating, a winning combination, especially when a chaotic world can make sobriety seem overrated. You go on then to compare that to sort of how we use television through the latter part of the 20th century. Describe what you were wanting to get at with that analogy.
Well, the transition in London was really the rise of industrialization. Suddenly, the jobs were in an urban area. Before, there had been a mix of big city jobs, village jobs, rural jobs, and suddenly industrialization moved the jobs to where the machines were. And so people began pouring into London. And that incredible increase in population strained all the modes people had for urban life. And they self-anesthetized with gin, as I write about in the book. And what struck me about the gin craze, as it was called in London at the time, is first that they were self-anesthetizing around this transition into an industrial economy. And second, that no amount of law passed by Parliament could see the gin craze off. What stopped it instead was the decision to treat having that many people together as a source of civic opportunity rather than as a crisis. So the analogy there is with the growth in free time after the Second World War. We had several factors: rising educational attainment, rising life expectancy, an increase in sort of post-industrial jobs that left the nation and increasingly the world with an enormous amount of free time. But this came about as we were also suburbanizing, moving further and further away from one another. And the thing that stepped into the gap was television. Television has become the primary use of free time in the developed world for really, you know, almost everyone. And the analogy I'm making there is to think of the sitcom as our gin, the thing we used to manage this transition away from the traditions of life as they existed prior to the Second World War and into this kind of industrial, post-industrial mix, the newly suburbanized living situations. And the incredibly rapid growth of television to become the dominant media is unprecedented in media history. And it left us with, as you said in the introduction, it left us with a media landscape where really the main activity was just continuous consumption.
Nicholas Johnson, the former FCC commissioner, once called TV the plug-in drug. So in your view, is it literally that sort of anesthesia?
It is, in my view, literally that sort of anesthesia. All of those kinds of analogies have turned out to have a biological basis. The research that I'd done for the book that I think most seemed sort of have the greatest explanatory force around that drug-like effect of television is something called the social surrogacy hypothesis. It has long been observed that television is like having a set of imaginary friends. The social surrogacy hypothesis measures the way in which that's literally true, that when we turn on television, we feel less lonely. But the terrible irony of that is that in so doing, we actually disconnect ourselves further. So it is a palliative for the very symptoms it worsens.
And you point in your book to some research that indicates that people who are unhappy watch more TV than people who are more content.
People who are unhappy watch more TV than people who are content. And the truly awful parallel observation is that people who watch more TV become unhappier. So there is this strange kind of self-preserving feedback loop around television, which is one of the ways it became, you know, the majority free time activity worldwide.
Clay Shirky, our guest this hour. He teaches at New York University, and his new book is called Cognitive Surplus: Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. But the focus of your book then is on how things are changing now,
right,
and that we now have the opportunity for our media to be much more not only interactive, but we can produce it, not just consume it. An example you give early on is the TV series Lost. Describe how, in a way, a conventional network series, though, has now prompted a different kind of response rather than just sitting on the couch and watching it.
Right. Well, the great surprise around the current media landscape, obviously with the addition of the internet, mobile phones, and so forth, is that we have a media landscape now that lets us not just consume, but also, as you said, to produce and to share. And what we see people doing is producing and sharing sometimes on their own, sometimes around existing media. And so Lost became one of the early examples of a show whose fan base was so obsessively involved with the show that they took to aggregating in public on bulletin boards and so forth, discussing the show, creating Lostpedia, of course, as how could one not? And we started to see that the kind of engagement that was possible around entertainment, but really around anything, was different than what we'd experienced in the 20th century.
So your premise is that now we can do something different. We still have, although we're obviously in a difficult economic circumstance, so free time may or may not be quite as prevalent. But your basic premise is we can do something different now. Outline what it is, besides something like Lostpedia, that people now have the opportunity to do that either pushes back at the media they're receiving or creates a new social good.
Well, let me tell the story of Hugh Shahidi, because I think that's one of the things that illustrates what's possible now that wasn't possible 10 years ago. Hugh Shahidi is a crisis mapping tool. It was invented in Kenya in the aftermath of a disputed election in 2007. And all it did was to take reports of violence in the field, whether from the web or mobile phones, and aggregate them and put them on a map. So it took the tacit knowledge that exists in society. Everybody knows where the violence is, but they know it only in small pockets. And it turned it into a public resource and made it visible. And that worked so well that the programmers who created the Hugh Shahidi platform decided to share it and spread it. It's now been used worldwide, right? It's been used in the aftermath of the earthquake in Chile and Haiti. It's been used to track electoral fraud in Mexico. And what Hugh Shahidi does would not have been possible without digital technology, but what Hugh Shahidi does would also not have been possible without human generosity. And to me, what I'm calling cognitive surplus takes advantage of both facts, mm-hmm. both that we have these intrinsic motivations to do productive social things with one another, and we also have a new way of channeling those ancient motivations onto the public stage, right?
So. And that public stage, in one case, is quite literal, and that's in the case of what happens with people who are great fans of the musician Josh Groban.
Oh, yes.
So you have this – the story you just told about something that's quite acute, the problem in Kenya. And then you have also this interesting other story that's also about generosity in a different form.
Right. Well, and in a way, this is one of the great themes of the book, is all the different ways that these intrinsic motivations can manifest themselves. I love the Grobanites for charity. This is a group of fans of Josh Groban, the singer who sings a sort of style of music sometimes called classical crossover or popera. And they decided to make a donation in his name on his 21st birthday and pass the hat and raise some money. And everybody felt good enough about that they did it again and again. And then one of their number, Julie Clark, said, you know, we could do this online. We could have an auction, right? This was back in 2002 when nothing on the web worked particularly well, but they got some sort of white label auction software. And they were suddenly able to raise 10 times the amount they'd ever raised by passing the hat. And so they go and they really invest as a group, the group that calls themselves the Grobanites for Charity, in this activity. And they make it central to their sense of self, to their participation as fans of Josh Groban, as people who can make a difference in the world. And that group, which just started literally as a sort of single idea about a birthday party for a pop music star, has turned into a charity that's raised $1 million over the life of its existence. You know, not bad for a bunch of amateurs.
And in that, you argue that it's fundamentally changed our notion of what sharing is. We used to think to share, we had to be face-to-face, as you and I are at this moment, that if I wanted to show you a picture of my daughter, for example, I had to pass it over to you. What you're suggesting is that sharing now doesn't have that sort of face-to-face boundary.
It doesn't have to have that face-to-face boundary. I'm not saying that the face-to-face sharing remains unchanged. What's happened is the repertoire of sharing has expanded over both time and space. So to go back to the Ushahidi example, the people who work on Ushahidi as a platform, or the people who contribute their observations to various bits of crisis mapping, are literally all over the world. If you look at the map on the Ushahidi homepage, you see there's instantiations in India, there's instantiations in Washington, D.C., there's North America, there's South America, all over Africa. So all of a sudden, the generosity of the participants is worldwide. And at the same time, the generosity can be very long-lived, right? Anybody who even uploads a photo or a video to Flickr or YouTube is engaging in an act of potential sharing. And those photos or videos can be there for years, and then someone may find them and get some value out of them. So this increase in the radius and the half-life of our generous behaviors is one of the things that makes the new media landscape so remarkably different.
And yet, of course, that doesn't necessarily occur. You have just as much opportunity to, be a couch potato in front of your computer screen as you do your television set. I mean, I happen to be, for example, a big college sports fan. So I can spend a lot of time looking at the Stanford College football site, which is not a whole lot more generous or productive than watching a television program. So are you arguing that it makes us more generous, or that we have that opportunity, but we also still have the opportunity to be just as slovenly as in the past?
It's really the latter, which is to say, I'm not saying that people don't like to consume. We still like to consume, obviously. It's just that we also like to produce and we like to share. And so having a media landscape which gives us the opportunity to do those other things, even if we don't take up that opportunity all the time, is still a sea change. It's remarkable now, you know, five, six years into Facebook, 10 years into the social networking revolution in general, how much we've forgotten that in the 20th century it was impossible for the average citizen to say something in public that could be widely disseminated. We're getting used in a way to the idea that publishing is something that everyone can do. But in fact, that change alone is a bit of generous behavior. If I just put something out there for other people to find, even if it's just a group of two dozen of my friends, that's already an improvement over the landscape that I grew up in anyway.
Well, and fundamentally has changed the role of journalism or who gets to be a journalist. If you look at, and you touch on this in the book as well, what happened in Iran with cell phone reporting, or the London bombing, subway bombing from 5 years ago, that has all fundamentally changed as well, which makes, people anxious sometimes, people like me.
Right. the London bombing case, I think, was particularly salient around these chains because it wasn't just journalists. It was the government's own position, right? After – these are the July 7th bombings in 05. And the official story was – it's been a terrible electrical accident in the underground. We've shut the system down. We've shut the subway down. We're evacuating. We'll get back to you with more details. And Ian Blair, the head of the Metropolitan Police, was the person who was then going to speak to the public, and they assumed that they would then spend the rest of the day figuring out what was going on. But within an hour and a half of the bombs going off, people were circulating photos of a double-decker bus that had been blown up, clearly not underground, clearly not with an electrical system. And suddenly Blair realized, and to his credit, acted on the realization, that his choice was no longer about whether or not to start a conversation with the public about this act of terrorism, but rather whether he was going to participate in a conversation that had been kicked off without him. And I come down on the side, you know, I have a simple-minded American view about this sort of thing. I think freedom is good, right? And we've got freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly. But freedom of the press and freedom of assembly have been unevenly distributed relative to freedom of the speech. So I think that living in a world in which freedom of the press and freedom of assembly, which is to say freedom of public expression and coordinating capabilities, are more widely distributed, is a basically good thing for society. But I also recognize that it's quite disruptive.
Clay Shirky, our guest. Again, his new book, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. So where do you come down in this world now where everything can be shared and everybody can be a reporter in a sense, and how you sift and sort through that? Because while it's true that those first images of what happened in London came to us not from a BBC reporter with his big TV camera, but in the way that you describe, it also means that there's sort of everything out there all of the time, and people can wind up thinking something is true, and of course it's not. Not that that wasn't a problem in the old journalism either, but still in all, you at least have some of that information was, you know, curated in a certain way. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you believe that you know, every journalist needs an editor, every author needs an editor, yeah? So,
yes.
But now editors are less important, right?
It's not that editors are less important. It's that the importance has shifted from away from managing bottlenecks. So to the degree that the old publishing landscape, whether publishing now in the sense of any kind of putting out of material, whether from a broadcast tower or a printing press, in the old publishing landscape, if it was only the professionals who put material out in the public. And so the editorial function was twofold. It was to improve the material that was put out, and it was also essentially to manage this incredible scarcity, the scarcity that turned out to sort of underlie the economic model. The need to make things better quality than they are, you know, as someone who has just finished a book is always grateful for the services of editors, the need for people to help make things better than they are remains intact, but the scarcity premium is gone. And that leads to the issue you raised about the volume of information, right? Now, from my point of view, it's not an information overload problem. We've always had information overload since the invention of the printing press, right? Since there were more books than a person could read in a lifetime. The problem we've got now is filter failure, right? We no longer the ways we managed filtering among different kinds of information in the 20th century are broken in the 21st. Both because of the volume of information just defeats that kind of filtering in advance, but also because we're no longer in a world where most publicly available content is produced by professionals.
And we're also now in this world where so much is coming at you. There are people who argue that in itself is part of the problem. You're saying information overload isn't it. It's the filtering. But you know, there's a story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about, you know, we're getting too much and we're not able to sort it. And people think that we can multitask, but we really can't.
Right.
And there've been research at Stanford and other places that shows people who are doing stuff all the time actually aren't very good at processing things and keeping straight. So where do you come down on that?
Well, you know, I think Nicholas Carr has done the best work on this, and he's got a book out now called The Shallows. Which goes into exactly this thesis. Although the brain research is preliminary, I think one of the things we can take for granted is that there is no such general mental skill as multitasking, and that doing two tasks at the same time turns out to be suboptimal, and that getting interrupted all the time turns out to be suboptimal. The question we've got now is essentially, what do we do about that, right? And so I think that the multitasking isn't a general capability argument is now widely understood and believed. What I found frustrating about The Shallows, although Carr does the best job, I think, of unpacking that research, is that he's completely mute on the subject of possible responses. So I keep hearkening back to the print revolution because it was the other great revolution which democratized the number of producers, not just the number of consumers. And when we look around at print culture, right, whether it's teaching five-year-olds to read or how libraries are laid out, we see that actually a lot of what we think of as print culture wasn't a response to books. It was a response to the problems books caused, right? All of a sudden, you have to have a separation between fiction and nonfiction and, you know, the idea of different disciplines just to sort the books on the shelf. So I think we may face a similar issue now with concentration as our half a millennium ago, forebears faced with literacy, which is it may be something that, like literacy, we have to teach in schools.
But it comes at you, doesn't it, at a much different pace. I mean, it's not exactly analogous to looking through the library and deciding which book you want to buy. It comes at you, and it comes at you early on, so that little kids have cell phones right. and are exposed to everything at a right. much different right. Right. level right. and rate than used to happen.
Right. And, you know, I mean, in my family, we don't have a television, and the kids don't have their own computers. They yeah. use a family computer that's in the living room, and they only use it by permission.
So you're the editor. I mean, you have
right,
to
exactly.
play that role.
So as always, I don't know if you remember the V-chip fiasco in the Clinton administration when people objected to violent content on television and then they were going to put in a V-chip. But the V-chip was essentially the desire of parents to abdicate their responsibility to the technology. That's just generally a bad idea. It doesn't matter what the technology is. So this is, I think, exactly what I mean about the idea of social response, right? On the subject of distraction and interruption, I think the important debate right now isn't between optimists and pessimists. Everybody, you know, who would disagree with the hypothesis that the internet is distracting? I think the important debate is between the hand-wringers and the experimenters, right? We clearly have to do something to shield kids from simply being caught up in a casually multitasking, interrupt-driven environment. You know, I work at it, but getting good at that is one of our jobs as a society right now.
We have to take a break in a second, but is part of your argument then also to direct kids towards these sharing opportunities, that it isn't just a cool thing that you can do 14 things at once, that it also enables you to maybe develop some neat sharing generosity-based project that you wouldn't have been able to do in the past?
Certainly social engagement is one of the things that produces a lot of both continuity and concentration because we respond well when other people respond well to us. So kids who are part of a community of other kids doing things that they all care about are able to concentrate longer because they're getting away from some of the kind of pure machine-like interrupt-driven stuff, and they're actually dealing with other people.
Clay Shirky, the book Cognitive Surplus: Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'd like to hear your views on this subject. How do you deal with everything that's coming at you? Have you experimented with developing a project that is based on generosity and sharing in the way that Clay Shirky is describing? Here's a number if you want to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can just go to our website, kqed.org/forum, add in your comments online, and we'll incorporate those into our discussion as well. Back in just a moment with more with Clay Shirky, the author of Cognitive Surplus: Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Clay Shirky is our guest this hour, the New York University professor, author of a new book called Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. We welcome your thoughts and participation, too. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Add in your comments online or email them to us at forum@kqed.org. Before we take our first call, Clay Shirky, I want you to tell the story that I found, one of the stories I found particularly fascinating in your book. It's a story about a college student at Ryerson University who did something that makes perfect sense, but got him in a whole lot of trouble and really speaks to the way in which interconnectedness poses fascinating questions for our time.
Well, this gets at some of the stuff we were saying before the break about the kind of need for cultural adaptation. It isn't just adding a new technology. The story starts when a kid named Chris Avenir, who's in his first semester of college, he's taking a chemistry class, chemistry 101. It's a hard class. So what does he do? He starts a study group, right? Or he joins a study group, right? Because that's what you do when you're in college and you're taking a technically hard class. But alas for him, because he's 19 and it's the year it is, he joins a Facebook study group. And he becomes one of the administrators in the study group. And then the chemistry professor who's given the assignments sees the existence of this Facebook group, although he doesn't join and can't see what they're doing on the inside. The way the Facebook group is presented makes it look like they're cheating rather than being in a study group. So rather than investigate further, he just goes down and gets Chris Avenir called up on charges. So there's this kid, second semester freshman, who's suddenly facing 147 charges of academic misconduct, one for being an administrator of the Facebook group and another 146 for every other student who was part of the group. And the incredible thing about that story is it takes something that's always been true of colleges, right? There's always been this tension between college as a place where learning is socialized. You talk to people in the dining hall. You meet in seminar classes. You discuss things. And also, learning is a personal activity. You're responsible for your own work. No plagiarism. We're going to give you a diploma. And those two forces have been held in equilibrium inside colleges for centuries, but mainly because no one could really see the conflict, right? The diploma was a very public act and the study groups were a very private act. Suddenly, with Facebook putting it out in public, that old bargain is broken. And so Avenir became a lightning rod. Now, fortunately, they did not kick him out. He's still at Ryerson. But he became a lightning rod for the college realizing that the old bargain can't be held in place with any single metaphor anymore. And they're just going to have to renegotiate what it means to be a student in a social situation.
And as you suggest in the book, it also – you're somewhat sympathetic to the questions that were before the university because it really does alter the equation, so to speak, about how education takes place. It raises real questions about – what exactly education is.
Right. And in fact, this tension between learning as a communal activity and learning as a sole responsibility, we need both things going on side by side in colleges. And certainly the advantage of a Facebook study group is it's easier to get going, more people can join. Right. The disadvantage of a Facebook study group is that it's easier to have free riders. So if anyone is minded to cheat, it's actually easier to sponge off someone's homework online because in a way lurkers are rarely detected. So the college really did have some reason to worry. It's not an easy question. And although my sympathies go out to Avenir because he happened to get the short end of this particular stick, the larger questions are real and deep and are both personal and institutional.
And speak to some of the things we were also discussing before the break about there's always a need for editors. There's always a need for parents. There's always a need to deal with these things in a face-to-face kind of way. To our callers, Michael in Oakland is first. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. This is a great topic and, obviously very timely for many of us parents of budding teens
yeah.
who are, inundated with the options. So, it's nice. I don't know how old your kids are, but they don't want to hear it, and limiting the computer and limiting TV and so forth is obviously an ongoing discussion. But how do you convince kids that
well,
that's okay?
So right now I have fiat on my side, which is to say my kids are 6 and 9. So I'm still a relative authority figure around my house, though I can already feel that fading with my older one. But one of the things we do is we actually just don't physically have a television in the house. And frankly, of any medium that produces sort of distraction and eats up free time, television is still by far the most significant part of the media landscape. But the other thing we've done is that we are in and have been for a couple of years in a negotiation, particularly with my older one, about when he can have a phone, right? He wants one. He sees all the adults around him having one. They look like they're fun. And we've made it clear that he can have a phone when he can go around on his own, right? When, you know, so when he's, I don't know, 11 or whatever, and he can take the subway by himself. We're in New York. Then he'll have a phone. But we're trying to make it not just a question of, oh, you've turned a certain age, and so here's a particular device you can use, but also to explain essentially why we would give him one of these things.
And where do you land, Clay Shirky, on some of what Michael is also raising about, for example, something like Facebook? There's a lot of parents have great concerns about kids being way too exhibitionist about their lives. And you mentioned in the book that, you know, if Facebook had been around when you were a teenager, you probably would have done that too. So it's not kids have become less ethical. It's that they have the means that they once did. But where are you at with that?
Right. Well, so yeah, to that latter point, it drives me crazy. I'm tail end baby boom, and it drives me crazy when I hear baby boomers taking anything like a moral stance about sharing in social media. You know, well, we didn't do those sorts of things when we were in college, but of course, nobody gave us the chance. And I remember us; we would have done it in a heartbeat if we'd had it. I don't think, in fact, that there's an epidemic of this kind of exhibitionism. There are certainly salient examples, and those get people very worked up. But in fact, a majority of Facebook users are setting some kind of privacy control. My concern is much more about what Facebook is doing to continually set and reset the defaults towards openness. The kids, left to their own, only want to show the pictures to their friends, whatever the pictures are, and they're mostly, you know, completely innocuous. But it is in fact the big operative question here is about what Facebook does as the defaults for privacy, rather than the kids' behaviors. To Michael's other observation, that, you know, about, oh, well, my kids are driving me crazy. In a way, this is just adolescence, right? The bargaining is always going to be part of this. And, you know, I think for any parent, and I'm saying this projecting into the future and also remembering my own past, I think you just have to, you know, as a parent, you just have to get ready to lose the battles and hope you lose them at the moment that the kids are responsible enough to care about what they fought for.
And perhaps also remember who's the parent.
Mm. But that, I mean, that in general, this is back to the V-chip thing. The idea that human beings are helpless in the face of technological change, that we don't get to choose which devices to use or how or what the limits are, is a weird kind of techno-determinism. It used to be that the optimists were techno-determinists. Now it's the pessimists are techno-determinists.
To Paul in San Francisco. Paul, you're up. Go ahead.
Hi. Clay Shirky, great program.
Thanks, Paul.
You raised the question of production. When the printing press was invented, how it all of a sudden created a whole new field of work, that is, anybody could publish a book. So how is the internet going to improve production so that, say, somebody that's unemployed right now wanted to create a job? You know, all kinds of people have tried this on the internet, of creating jobs, but it doesn't seem to work for people. I'm not one of those, but a lot of my friends have tried doing this, and it doesn't seem to work. What do you see as how the internet is going to actually improve production of jobs?
Well, typically what happens is, and this happened also with the printing press, is that any massive shock to a system, you know, any massive shock of abundance both destroys old jobs and creates new jobs. And as I say in the book, abundance is a bigger stress on society than scarcity. So what we're seeing with the internet is that a lot of old jobs are coming under pressure. We were talking about this a little bit before the break. So the jobs that are being created are very often not analogous to the jobs that were being destroyed. So there are, you know, there's an entire internet industry now whose jobs have been created around this medium. What we don't yet know is how many of those jobs are going to be essentially freelance jobs, right? How many people can make a living setting up some kind of media or production company? Very often, when you look at I talk about Eichen Has Cheeseburger in the book, right? When you look at this, the business of Eichen Has Cheeseburger is actually publishing books on the side from the material gathered on the site. So I think in many cases, the jobs that are being created, at least the jobs that are sort of being self-created by individuals or small groups, have to do with finding something that people value, acting as the kind of filter you were talking about earlier, and then producing or selling that material.
Well, and you one example you cite that's on more on the sort of more casual side of this that is indicative of the kinds of new things, new jobs, new industries that are created is couchsurfing.com.
Right. Well, so couchsurfing is interesting because it is, a classic example. It's a shock to the cost of travel, as it were, because it enables people to find some remote location where there's somebody who's got a couch that they could crash on. And you've got people now traveling around. They're kind of ad hoc hostels. And the interesting thing about couchsurfing is that the couchsurfing site is that they spend an extraordinary amount of time on reputation systems, exactly as eBay does and for the same reason. So that is a site that simultaneously creates an enormous amount of value for its participants and also creates a business opportunity for the people who run the site itself.
To Kathy in Woodland. Kathy, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, Kathy, you're on. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you very much. My question is that since the internet produces such fast responses from everybody, how can we as a public give our leaders and our politicians time to react to a crisis situation without an immediate response back? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
That is such a good question. One of the interesting things that's going on right now is that as media speeds up, right, as we move into Twitter and SMS driven media, is that it also gets more emotional because we feel much, much faster than we think. And so anyone's immediate response is going to be an emotional reaction to something. I will tell you that the example I've seen that gives me the most hope for the kind of discipline I think you're talking about, Kathy, was the Ian Blair example we were talking about earlier, where Blair had to go out and address the British people within 90 minutes of the incorrect story about the London bombing having been circulated, about the electrical explosion. Blair had to go out and say, clearly, this is a terrorist attack. Clearly, we are facing a new kind of challenge in Britain. And I don't have all the answers. Hmm. I don't know everything yet. You will have to trust me and the Metropolitan Police to go back and do our work, and we will get back to you when we know more. And I think that willingness of a senior political figure to go out and say, I'm going to level with you, but I'm not going to overextend myself. I'm not going to overpromise. That is a kind of discipline that I think we need to see more of, precisely because these conversations are becoming more rapid and ongoing. I think the response needs to be like Blair's response.
And is there a distinction between how Blair responded in that circumstance and what President Obama has been criticized for not responding more quickly enough? In a press conference, this is long before the Gulf incident, a reporter once asked him, well, this happened – I can't even remember what the it was, but this happened 24 hours ago. Why haven't you said something yet? And the president's response was, well, I actually like to know something before I say something.
Right.
But with him, there is this kind of almost professorial reserve that on the one hand is admirable. But what you're suggesting, it seems to me slightly different, which is you better get out there fast because information is fast. You don't necessarily have to be definitive in what you say, but you need to at least acknowledge that that's going on.
Right. I think in particular in the case of the BP oil spill, the mistake was really that everyone believed something different was happening. There was no real sense of how bad the situation was. And I think because the growing realization that this was the worst environmental catastrophe we have ever faced as a nation came so gradually, I do think the Obama administration reacted too late. I think a statement of the sort he finally made, there was nothing in his sort of first address from the Oval Office about that crisis that could not have been made several days earlier. Yeah. There was no new information. So whatever he was waiting for, it wasn't to know more things. And that strikes me as being essentially outside these dynamics of ongoing conversation.
Clay Shirky. His book again, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. Time for you to join our conversation still if you want to call us at 866-733-6786 or to email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Patrick next in San Jose. Patrick, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity and thanks for sharing actually your work. I had one taken to one of the examples that the guest mentioned earlier. He called, there was a website or a tool in Kenya called the Ushahidi.
Yep.
In Swahili, I'm from Tanzania, so it caught me by surprise. I'm like, what do you mean by Ushahidi? It's pronounced Ushahidi, and what it really means is the witnessing.
Right.
And one of the things that I kind of draw from it is that, you know, in a lot of places around the world where violent acts have happened, like genocide in Rwanda and all these other places, one of the things, the biggest drawback from these events, is first of all, is that the reports were, accurate reports were not there. In fact, there was actually absence of reporting of those violent acts around the region. The other thing that is happening is that the reaction of the government towards those violent acts, especially if the government or members of government have been involved. So it's kind of I've been following up through the Kenya situation, but I wasn't familiar with the tool you mentioned. But drawing from that is that these acts are now very much so available from the tool. The only questions that are the things that maybe you can chime on is on it, tools like these where people are able to sharing their witness of what they've seen, the impact it would have to the society in the form of, for instance, in a government response, whether that is executive order, judiciary body or parliament systems, how they're going to react to such a rapid information coming in.
Patrick, thanks. Thanks for the observation. That is, I mean, an interesting observation that Patrick makes about the importance of witnessing in part is or its consequence is dependent on how people respond to it.
Right. Well, and Ori Akola, the lawyer in Nairobi who kicked off Ushahidi, and I apologize for my pronunciation, is that she started it after the Kenyan government imposed a media blackout. And so it was exactly in the absence of the kind of reporting that Patrick is talking about that the project kicked off. And the great question, of course, as with all of this stuff, you know, as with the Green Uprising in Tehran after the June elections, as with the monitoring of the post-election violence between, you know, Kikuyu and Luo in Kenya, is will the government react to public evidence of wrongdoing? In the Kenyan case, the government was slow to act, and also because the crisis mapping was itself a response to an ongoing crisis, it didn't have the ability to shape this material. But in a study that Harvard Humanitarian Initiative did, it turned out that the material gathered on Ushahidi was actually more accurate, more complete, and often in advance of mainstream reporting on the same violence. So the platform itself is now working as a site of witness or testimony. And the government response becomes the open question.
Do you see a way, since we're still in the middle and will be in the middle of the Gulf crisis for a long time, that any of this could be, you know, you're talking before, Clay Shirky, about the, you know, you don't want to just wring your hands. You want to contend. You want to engage.
Right.
Is there a way that this interconnectedness that you're talking about, the spirit of generosity, could be engaged further with the Gulf? I'm just casting about here. I don't even really know quite what that would be. But is there a way that you can imagine these tools, this technology, helping in this circumstance?
You know, I mean, I think we all hope so. I actually, at NYU, I teach a class in partnership with UNICEF, and we try to take some of the service design principles we've seen on the web about participation and about aggregating information, and to design them around applications that assume radios and mobile phones rather than expensive computers and high-speed connections. And there is some work going on right now in Jordan, which is essentially where a lot of the Iraqi support networks are, both NGO support networks and also just expatriates, trying to do exactly this, trying to find ways to coordinate citizen response to everything from graft to outbreaks of violence. I mean, we see the reports about the bombings and the IEDs, of course, and those are horrific. But the long-term threat to Iraqi civilians in terms of the stability of their government has much more to do with corruption and ethnic self-dealing than it does with improvised explosive devices. And so there are people working on systems where citizens can start to report episodes of corruption or graft and to aggregate those reports in the way that the Kenyans aggregated reports of violence.
And could in the current environmental disaster in the Gulf, could that also be applied to be able to pinpoint, I see the oil here now? I mean, one of the problems seems to have been that we don't exactly know where this is going and we respond too late in this kind of complicated environment with lots of bayous and islands and all the rest. Could that be deployed in that kind of way?
You know, it's interesting. There was just a report of a third grade class finding a cave on Mars, right? NASA, in fact, has done an incredible amount of effort, has committed an incredible amount of effort to getting so-called click workers to identify features like supernovas and crater mapping, right? So they're harnessing this, you know, cognitive surplus worldwide. And you look at that and you think, you know, I'd rather someone found where the oil slick was watching up on the beach in Mississippi. So people are very, very good at reading maps and photos. And I think that the next, I mean, God forbid, but the next time one of these creeping large-scale disasters happens, I hope that the satellite imagery becomes as accessible as NASA has made its imagery for that reason.
Dan in Livermore is next. Dan, you're on. Dan, go
Hello?
Ahead, please. Yes, you're on.
Sorry, I thought you said Dan. My name is Van, and the reason I'm calling, I'm wondering about the connective nature of Facebook and some of these other new technologies, and whether, you know, by virtue of their basic unidimensional and superficial type of connection that they create, that that's not distorting, you know, the social context in which people see themselves, how they interact, and whether they truly are making a social connection that they can rely on.
Van, thanks. Sorry we got your name wrong.
Yeah, so the question of sort of strong versus weak ties, as it were, which is to say people you have a deep relationship with versus people you have an acquaintanceship with, is an incredibly active area of research. One of the things we know about social networks in general, like Facebook, is that they're very good at creating acquaintance-like ties, but that getting to be, you know, having some kind of ongoing relationship with someone tends to involve a mix of mediated and face-to-face contact. However, what we're also seeing is that people are increasingly using these tools to actually coordinate real-world actions, to coordinate getting together in the real world. So the internet for young people is increasingly an augmentation of real life rather than as an alternative to it. I think the one thing I'd caution is believing that social life was in some kind of appropriate and God-given mode right up to 2004, and all of a sudden we're seeing a distortion, which is to say social life has essentially been distorted from anything we could call evolutionarily stable since the invention of agriculture. So there is no natural state of relationships among people that we could locate in any technologically sophisticated community. So I think the question for Facebook isn't, is it a distortion, but rather, given that there's a change going on, what's the best possible use we can make of it?
And so your sense would be that rather than worry about whether or not people are spending all their time on Facebook as opposed to being with faces in person, that the what you would want your kids to do, for example, would be to use that just as one more tool, just like we used to use just an old-fashioned telephone, to augment and to get together and to forge closer face-to-face connections.
And I think anybody who, you know, again, in the baby boomer set, anybody can remember sort of in adolescence talking to a boyfriend or girlfriend. Sometimes it was an hour-long conversation on the phone, and so the phone was a replacement for being able to talk face-to-face. And then sometimes it was a two-minute call, like, hey, I'll meet you down, you know, I'll meet you at the movies or whatever. And so the phone also became a medium where you could either have some kind of long, completely mediated conversation, or you could use it to coordinate real-world activities.
Let's go to Kate in San Diego next. Kate, go ahead.
Hi, Clay. I was listening with interest about your Lost example, how the fans got so involved. I think you're a little late to the game on that. We've been writing fanfic and getting involved in television and media since Star Trek. I mean, I started writing fanfic in 1982, for crying out loud.
Okay, thanks. Interesting point. So you're dated, Clay.
No, sure. The question here, I think, isn't whether or not there's fanfiction. In exactly the same way as there were fanzines before there were weblogs. I think the question here is one of both scale and involvement, which is to say, you know, the fanfiction world has exploded with the lowering of these, you know, with the lowering of the hurdles to get in. So when you go look at fanfiction, you look at the fanfiction sites now, the Harry Potter fanfiction universe has exploded. And this is, I think, one of the things that people often miss about the media landscape is that what happens in a revolution isn't that some entirely new set of effects appears, but rather some existing set of effects suddenly becomes enormously accelerated. Right. So we had, you know, to go back to the fanzine example, right, the sort of fact sheet 5 world, there were always people sort of making and Xeroxing and stapling fanzines and mailing them out to 30 people or what have you. So it's possible on one hand to look at, say, weblogs and say, oh, well, nothing new is happening. But it's also possible to look at weblogs and say the scale of this is so unbelievably much more vast than it was before, that something different is happening. So my interpretation of the fan fiction world is that the explosion created by this ease of use has made fan fiction and involvement with things like Lost a much larger and more intense phenomenon than it was.
Clay Shirky, we'll have to leave it there. His new book, again, is called Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Forum is produced by Tina Lorberg and Erica Kelly, along with our regular producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.